Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello, 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 hello.
Hello, hello, hello.
Welcome once more to the purgatory that is Pete and Gary's Military History. Now this week, Pete, we are going to be talking about the August Anzac Offensive of the 6th of August onwards, 1915.
Sounds exciting, Gary.
It's as exciting as watching Fred sleep, which we are currently doing.
Well, let's hope he's all of him is asleep.
He can still practice his particular arts whilst asleep, though, Pete.
Particular arts from his arse.
Indeed, indeed. Yes. You're looking particularly radiant today, Pete.
I feel radiant. I've walked over to your place in sunny White Hart Lane, home of your favourite football team, Arsenal. Tottenham Hotspur, one of those.
Yeah.
So what are we doing today then?
Well, it's a series of attacks at Helles. There had been a series
We've
of attacks.
We've done that. I remember.
There'd been a series of attacks at Helles. They'd all failed. You'd had 1st, 2nd, 3rd, 158th Grithia. Which was battle to the 28th of June, battles of the 12th, 13th of July. They had all failed to break through to Attie Baba.
So what were they going to do then?
Well, if you remember rightly, that was the first day objective, and then they were. That was only the first step onwards towards the real objective of Khalid Bahia, which our good friend Bulent refers to as the big bastard.
Yeah, with good reason, in my view.
Now, there's nothing much other than the sort of a heroic defence, of course, had been happening at Anzac. Lieutenant General Sir William Birdwood commanding the Anzac Corps. He'd long been monitoring the situation in the north of Anzac, beyond the outputs of the foothills, and looking towards Suvla Bay in a sort of longing way. Meaningful looks.
Well, they couldn't make any progress at Anzac. It was just a defensive situation, wasn't it? They're just holding the line. Extremely brave. And hard working and defence against occasional massed Turkish attacks, particularly on the 19th of May. But fundamentally, they weren't going anywhere there. Neither side could break either in or out.
I think I'd seen it described in one place as a sort of bite out of the peninsula. They really did have a small area, didn't they?
It was very small. Not much room. To manoeuvre at all.
As you've mentioned before, you know, under constant threat all the time from the artillery.
So what artillery the Turks had, well, even rifle fire could reach the beaches. So it was very, very, it's a bad situation. So the idea of a breakout is attractive. Any side of the north of Anzac, let's just set the scene. There's a tangle of gullies and ridges and dead ends and all sorts of things. It's very rough terrain. We'll put a picture of that up. It's incredibly rough terrain, isn't it? Was there much sign of the Turks there?
No, there's not much sign, but there's a real chance that the Turks are relying on the sheer slopes. I mean, we've walked down these things and it's hard enough walking down them. So, you know, they're relying on the natural slopes to guard their northern flank.
So did Birdwood just take a chance or did he check it out first?
No. It's not just Birdwood. It's his staff as well. They dispatched scouts who find no serious Turkish presence. Now, gradually, this vision of a left hook out of Anzac dawned on them and moving into the valleys and then pushing up the ridges to seize the key heights of the Sari Bahia, thereby outflanking and evading the main Turkish defences. Now, it is very high ground there, Pete. We've walked it a number of times.
It's Hill 911 or whatever it is.
971, I think.
971, that is right. How did you remember this and not the other times?
But I don't know what it means. I don't know if that's feet, metres or inches.
Yeah, I hope it's not inches, otherwise it's not been a great performance. Now, something else is going on, because Hamilton's also considering a simultaneous landing at Suvla Bay. This is basically to solve the problems of lack of space. They just couldn't land. They'd got a series of new divisions had been assigned to the Gallipoli campaign. They decided they couldn't break through at Helles. They weren't allowed to land in Asia. But Kitchener had said, you're not landing in Asia, the other side of the straits. And so they thought that if they landed at Suvla Bay, which is to the north of these hills we're just talking about, even further north, in other words, then they'd have room to breathe. If they seized the high ground round the Suvla Bay plain, they'd be able to create a base and then act and manoeuvre as a formed body of men. It's not really part of the ANZAC plan, is it, though? It's happening at the same time. They've got enough on their own plate, haven't they?
Yeah, I mean, they'd help if possible, but really, they had enough on their own plate.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Now, so how do they set it? Well, they need moonless nights during the build-up. And so the twin offensives, ANZAC and Suvla, and we'll be doing a podcast on Suvla next time, were fixed for the 6th of the night of the 6th of August. So 6th of August. So, who drew up the plan?
Well, it's largely drawn up by the Chief of Staff, who's Brigadier General Andrew Skene.
ANZAC Corps Chief of Staff, yeah.
Yeah.
Not Hamilton's chief.
Oh, I see what you mean. Sorry, yeah. It's the plan for the ANZAC Corps that he
precisely,
draws up.
Yeah. Spot on.
Now, key element was a full-scale diversionary attack at 1730 on the 6th of August, which would be made on Lone Pine on the southern half of 400 Plateau.
Now, we're not dealing with that in this, because that is a diversionary attack, and we will be coming back to it in a full-scale podcast, probably next year, this time next year. But the idea is the fighting on Lone Pine, and we've been there, it's where the cemetery is. In fact, the area of the cemetery is basically the area that we're talking about. And what is the point? What are they trying to do with this diversion?
Well, they're trying to distract the Turkish attention, aren't they? They're trying to take them away from the left hook, which would be launched in a series of four columns marching out from ANZAC and along North Beach.
Now, so they're doing this diversion on the right of ANZAC as they look towards the Turks.
Yeah.
But we're going to punch out to
the
left. Now, they've got four columns, and these are normally described as this. I'll go through this because it's a little bit complicated, and I don't want to...
I can't do complicated.
You can, Gary. Think of all those...
I can tie my own laces.
Yeah. You're wearing slippers.
Oh, yeah, true.
So we've got the right covering force, and that was to seize the Turkish outposts in the foothills that commanded the valleys that led up to the Sari Bear Ridge. And then when that's done, the right assaulting column would advance through Sazli Bait Dere and Chalik Dere before ascending onto Rhododendron Ridge, and that would lead up to their objectives on Chunuk Bay.
Again, very, very, very high ground.
Very high ground and very steep. The left covering force would go further along the beach and then up Agil Dere before securing the left flank by overrunning Damakjelik Bear, which I wish I'd left you to say. And then the left assaulting column would carry on further along the Agil Dere before climbing up the Abdul Rahman Spur, which, as usual, we've walked down. If you remember, that's where Jim Maynard fell over. Leading up to Hill 971, as you so rightly said, Gary. Very, very good work there. And finally, there'll be a coordinated series of attacks launched out of ANZAC, aimed at the German officers' trench, the neck and the chessboard. So that's all along the left-hand side of the ANZAC sort of beachhead, if you like. It's not much more than a beachhead. That's the thing about Anzac. It is a beachhead. Do you think?
That all sounds a bit complicated, Pete, to be honest.
A bit complicated, a bit ambitious, perhaps?
Very ambitious. Do you think that's typical Hamilton?
Yeah, well, this is what we said about the plans for the 25th of April. Take no account of reality. And now, of course, there's a couple of other complexities. One is the terrain is god-awful. Secondly, the physical state of the troops. The lads are often riddled with dysentery or just knackered. And there's the distances to be covered. I mean, we've walked down it, but we've been hot, sweaty and tired, and we haven't got dysentery.
And how many bottles of water do we have?
A lot, that's right. Great point. And they haven't got Bain's disease, as it was so memorably described by Bryn Hammond, who had Hammond's disease. Pretty any flexibility in the plans, would you say, Gary?
Well, the timetable was so rigid, there'd be no scope for delays or mistakes, or the Turks would actually get on top of Serbia and be waiting for them. That was the risk.
Now, just as a throwaway, and this is classic Hamilton, his headquarters have the idea of a major holding operation to be launched by the 8th Corps at Helles. This is a full-on attack, and this is to prevent Turkish reserves marching north. It's about 15 miles to reinforce Anzac. What do you think of that plan?
Well, it's either brilliantly imaginative and well-planned programme or a complete cock-up that substitutes optimism for realism.
Now, the whole plan, I think that applies to. I think this is what it... And we've got a witness to this in someone who he's great, just a great man. And it's Lieutenant Colonel William Malone. He's a New Zealander, bad-tempered, miserable, sceptical, never particularly keen on something new. He wanted to maintain a tight control on everything to do with his battalion, the Wellington Battalion. And he didn't like all the variables that he could spot in this bloody plan of Hamilton's schemes and Birdwood's. And you're going to read a quote from William Malone of the Wellington Battalion and give it your full New Zealand accent. You don't know what a New Zealander sounds like, do you?
So I think this is what a New Zealander sounds like. I do not like this job. It will be night work. We have to wait on the Maoris and our mounted rifles clearing some hills and trenches over or by which we have to tackle the high ridge, and none of our troops are trained enough for night work in very rough country. We shall possibly mistake the Maoris for Turks, and the confusion in the dark will be terrible. If we could only start fighting at dawn and have the day before us, we should have it a real good fight. Artillery support and seeing what to do and when to go would be a treat. Still, it's not for me to decide. If, and a big if, the Maoris and mounted rifles do their job properly, then unless we get lost, ours ought to come off all right. And if too the Otago and Canterbury people do theirs, I wouldn't be surprised if the Wellington Battalion gets up alone, the first, and has to dig in and stick it out.
Now, in one way, we can tell this is what he thought before the operation, because, of course, the operation would do for him. This is from his letters home. The book of Malone's correspondence is a fantastic book. I will be putting that up for people to have a look at. He can see the risks, can't he? What he's talking about there, the Maoris and the Mounted, that's the right covering force. That's and he's sceptical as to whether they succeed. He's worried about the Otagos and Canterbury's getting up there. And he can see the Wellingtons being, well, shafted, if you see what I mean. So the 1st Brigade, 1st Australian Division, they're going to launch their diversionary attack on Lone Pine. We're going to come back to it. It's a diversion. It's dramatic. It's intense fighting. They do make some small gains, but do you think it really affects the position in Anzac?
No, I mean, it is what it is. It's a diversion to the main attacks. That's what it is. The real question was simple. Had the fighting at Lone Pine distracted sufficient attention from the great left hook from Anzac?
Oh dear, well, that's what we'll be finding out, isn't it? So darkness falls on the night of the 6th of August, and the four columns That's the left assaulting, the right assaulting, the left covering and the right covering, begin to file away out along the beach out of Anzac. And the covering forces do their job. They overwhelm the Turkish posts on the lower slopes. And the way's clear, the assaulting columns. It's going well, Gary, is it?
Yeah, but a night march, it's difficult at the best of times, Pete. But travelling over unfamiliar ground and fearing attack by the Turks at any moment, it's a true test of nerves.
Now, the left assaulting column we'll deal with first. We're not going to do much about these because it's a terrible story. It's the Australian 4th Brigade under the command of a friend of yours and ours. The second ever podcast that we did was about him, and that was John Monash. It's not his finest hour. There's something wrong with the 4th Australian Brigade at this time. Is it that they're not up to it as men, or is it something more insidious, something that's afflicting them?
Well, they've been there since 25th of April, and they're, you know, laughingly being described as Nile veterans by this stage. But at Gallipoli, that meant they're also riddled with dysentery, and they're pretty much enfeebled because of that. And as the long march dragged on, they fall further and further behind the optimistic predictions for their progress.
Now, you've had Bain's disease and you've been on long marches on that. And how do, it is difficult to move quickly to maintain your focus, isn't it? If you're dying to go out the loo every 10
minutes. And I'll take you back to my earlier comment. I had 6 to 8 bottles of water at any time. Yeah, these guys haven't.
That's it. So now, as they're going, the guides may or may not know the way, but the lads certainly don't. The officers and the people who made up these columns don't really know their way. They're continually stopping. And what happens if you keep stopping? The line concertinas and you drop to an almost standstill pace. Now, they have with them a local Greek guide and he takes them through a shortcut. Now, I've taken you through this very shortcut.
Greek thingy.
That very shortcut. Very, very shortcut. Now, what's the problem? It's called Taylor's Gap. What's the problem with it?
Well, it's very, very narrow. It's in a scrub-filled gully. And at times, you're reduced to single file. Now, we've been through it with about, I think it was 10 to 15 of us at the time. And we were reduced down to single file.
It was. And were we being harassed by Turkish snipers?
Yes.
That was Bullent, wasn't it?
Bullent, yeah. York. Bullent was throwing things at us, as I seem to recall. No, and I remember this is last year, Pete, and we did have a discussion about how effective sniping would be in that circumstance. And it took them about 3 hours, I think, to get through the 600 yards of the gap before they finally got into Agil Dere at about 2 o'clock in the morning.
And you can imagine it. And what that happens is that they keep stopping the column. They send people out to try and get deal with the snipers. Everybody's stopped. Monash is starting to panic. Now, the next thing is the 4th Brigade, Australian Brigade, they're meant to climb up Abdul Rahman to Hill 971. Behind them, 29th Brigade, Indian Brigade, we're going to go up. They're going to slightly more to the south and go towards Hill Q. The problem is that they get lost. Now, I've got lost there. You look at all these hills, they all look the same. You go a few degrees out and you're going up the wrong place. They don't go up Abdul Rahman Spur. They thought they were on it, but actually they were just on a continuation of Damak Jelik Bear. Hill 971 was miles away, if you like it. Much of it's a very steep climb. The troops are absolutely exhausted. They're riddled with dysentery. They're short of water. And Monash is panicking. You might remember from that podcast, he said, I thought I could lead men. He begins to doubt himself because it's just such an awful situation. It's probably the worst time he ever had in a command situation. And he orders a halt at daylight, which is not long after 2 o'clock, I suppose, in August. 29th Brigade don't do any better. They got lost in Agil Dere and they finish up the day well short of Hill Q. The big question though, Gary, is we still got that question, is the diversion working? But also, what's happening to the New Zealanders? Because the right assaulting column is the New Zealand Brigade, commanded by Brigadier General Francis Johnston. And which way are they going?
Well, they had not had quite so far to travel, and on the map, it looks deceptively simple. the Canterbury Battalion was to push up the Sesley Bight Deer. I'll let you say that one next time. While the Otago, Wellington and Auckland battalions moved up the Chalick Deer. Now, all four battalions are to rendezvous on Rhododendron Ridge between 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, at which point the final thrust would be made up the ridge and onto Chalick Bear, ready to attack down Battleship Hill towards the Neck.
In conjunction with the attacks from the Neck to be made by the Australian Light Horse. That's the plan. So how would you describe the terrain? We've been in that terrain. Was it easy going?
No. It's a living nightmare. You've got gullies that look so innocent looking on a map.
Lovely.
Just little gullies winding down.
What could go wrong?
But they're totally confusing in the dark. You know, what's the main course? Which was the best route to climb out and onto the right ridge? And they're surrounded by ridges.
And which is the right one? And it's dark. You can't see where they're going. And if you've got a low perspective, you cannot see where you're going at all. You're in a gully.
Now, the delays, they double and they redouble. But at last, the Wellington Battalion managed to get out past the tabletop and up onto Rhododendron Ridge itself. But this is at about 4:30 a.m.
They're badly late.
They're already badly behind schedule. But when Johnson made the fatal decision to wait until the whole force was assembled, as the Canterbury Battalion had not yet emerged from Sesley Bight Deer, what's happened to them?
I can tell you, because I'm going to be Lieutenant Colonel Jack Gethin Hughes, who's commanding the Canterbury Battalion. And he says this: after we'd been advancing some hours, I was astounded to get a message from Stuart that the guides had lost their way. Here was a dilemma. The whole success of the push depending on us doing our job on time. I was up against it and on my own having to decide quickly. To obey orders and occupy the hills, I thought would do no good to anyone. I felt also that the tail of my battalion, where the machine guns were, must be far in the rear, as we had been moving practically in single file owing to the narrow ravine for some hours, and it's easy to lose touch in the dark. Therefore, to give the orders to occupy the hills would, I felt sure, leave my men thinly extended over much of the country and easily mopped up by the enemy at daylight. I decided to disobey orders and take the battalion back to the beach and save it intact to fight another day. I knew I would be broken for it and thought of the disgrace to my family in New Zealand, but felt it was the only way to save the men. I gave the order to retire. At the spot where I had halted, the ravine was so narrow that the advance guard, now the rear guard, had to pass me in single file. Now, that, in one sense, that's one of four battalions in the brigade, isn't it? And it wouldn't have mattered that much. Not really, if it wasn't for one thing. What was the Brigadier Johnson doing during this time?
Well, he sort of sat still with his three battalions, waiting in vain for the Canterbury Battalion to appear. Now, to be fair to Johnson, he had serious health problems, although one of them's alleged to have included alcoholism.
Let's not be too fair to Johnson. There are serious allegations that he was drunk.
Yeah, and this is a criminal neglect of his responsibilities, as clearly laid out in Birdwood's orders. He was not to wait, but must push on regardless of the force, and he had to capture Chalick Bight before dawn and then press down through Battleship Hill before 04:30 in the morning, when the 3rd Light Horse Brigade were due to attack across the Neck.
Now, let's get this straight. They're already, even before this has happened, they'd only got up there at 4:30. The Wellingtons had only got up there at 4:30, so they're all, and that is not on Chalick Bight. This is on Rhododendron Ridge. So they're already, but then they stop, and wait for the Canterburys, who are arsing about in the gullies. It's not their fault; they're lost. Hughes, I've just read his quote. You can see that for one reason or another, he just can't find his way through, and he decides to go back and start again, if you like. But then he decides to have breakfast as well, Johnson. And that feeding your men is important, but is time not more important at this time? They finally resume their advance at 6:30 in the morning. Now, this might not have been important if the Lone Pine diversion, this is what we were talking about, the had been successful. Now, and was it? Was it successful?
Well, it was partly successful in the sense that it succeeded gloriously in sucking in the local reserves of the 5th Division, which were located around Kojadia Village, which is behind Gun Ridge.
A third ridge, yeah.
Yeah. Now, as such, they were not there to meet the New Zealanders on Chanuk Bair, but the very...
So that's great.
Yeah. Except the very success of the Lone Pine attack caused the 9th Division, which is commanded by Colonel Hans Kannengeiser, to be dispatched from further south. And when the dangers threatening Chanuk Bair become clear, the Turkish High Command merely ordered them to keep marching on up to the Surrey Bear Heights.
Now, you know where Kannengeiser's 9th Division were because you've stayed there. They were by the where the Kummertellers now,
yeah.
Which is where our battlefield tour trips stay. Mm. And so you can see that if they're marching from there to Lone Pine, then when the situation stabilises there, which it does when with the other divisions, the other forces, then they just carry on.
Just carry on, yeah.
This is the problem with Hamilton's plans. They're always too complicated. Kannengeiser gets up onto the summit of Chanuk Bair. About what time would you say?
Well, it's roughly at 7 o'clock in the morning. All times are estimates, Pete, but it is around 7 o'clock.
What could he see when
he could
there?
See groups of New Zealanders sort of below, moving forward very slowly to occupy the apex, which is about 500 yards away.
Yeah, it's a pointy bit, a bump in the ridge, isn't it? We've been there as well. It's a fantastic sight. And you're going to be Colonel Hans Kannengeiser, headquarters, 9th Division now.
The English approached slowly, in single file, splendidly equipped and with white bands on their left arms, apparently very tired, and were crossing a hillside to our flank, emerging in continually increasing numbers from the valley below. I immediately sent an order to my infantry. This was the 20-strong artillery covering platoon, instantly to open fire. I received this answer. We can only commence to fire when we receive the order of our battalion commander. This was too much for me altogether. I ran to the spot and threw myself among the troops who were lying in a small trench. What I said, I cannot recollect. But they began to open fire, and almost immediately the English laid down without answering our fire, or apparently moving in any other way. They gave me the impression that they were glad to be spared further climbing.
Now, that's a funny point, but I know where he's talking about. They've climbed all the way through there. They're tired. And they've been on the peninsula as well, the New Zealanders. They've got dysentery amongst their ranks as well. And it's a hell of a hill. We walked down it, as you rightly said, great point, and we've got plenty of water. And when he says that they gave the impression, I'm sure they were pleased to have a little lie down and rest and take cover. Now, at about 8 o'clock in the morning, Johnson holds a meeting with his commanders in the brigade. He's losing touch, and Malone is a cautious voice. Malone's saying, he's saying, an isolated attack in daylight, it's a strong position with any Turks up there, and he's calling for delay. So he also is breaking the plan. Let's be clear. He's advising breaking the plan. There's more delay then as the New Zealanders consolidate the position around the apex instead of pushing on up the ridge. Now, there's a problem because what happens every minute that ticks by?
Well, more of Kannengeiser's men are actually reaching a crucial spot and they're adding their weight to the defending force. Now, at last, Johnson acts, but perversely, after all the problems caused by waiting for the Canterbury Battalion, he sends just one battalion, the Auckland Battalion, in to make the assault, accompanied by two companies of the 2nd 10th Gurkhas, who were in effect stragglers from the 29th Indian Brigade.
Now, this is interesting because actually, I'm not sure you could get... It's quite a pointy ridge, to use a highly technical term. It's a narrow ridge. There might not have been room for many more. But the whole point was all these delays. By the time the Aucklands attack, it's a terrible attack.
Yeah, by the time they actually move forward, there's approximately 500 Turks waiting for them on the summit. Now, you're going to be Private Eric Lewis of the Auckland Battalion.
We were halted and lined up in three or more rows, bayonets fixed. Here we waited. To one end stood the brigadier, casually swinging his stick and gazing around. Finally, he glanced at his wristwatch and gave a blast on his whistle. "Go along, Colonel. Lead your men and charge!" The first line swept up and over, and the Turks, who up to then had been practically silent, let loose a murderous hail. A few survived that withering blast and ran on over the rough sloping hillside. The second row went and then followed the remainder. Where we were going, God only knew. We didn't. A trench was the objective, but it was no time to stop and take bearings. There seemed to be no covering fire and the enemy did as he liked. Finally, three of us plunged to earth in a shallow depression which afforded just sufficient cover and none to spare. Each move brought a burst of machine gun bullets. After a very careful survey of the surrounding few yards, the trench was spotted some 40 yards ahead. 40 feet ahead? Good grief. So not far at all. A wild spring and a rush, and two reached it and jumped in. The parapet being on the wrong side for us, the Turkish bullets hailed among the stones, but willing hands dragged us down. The trench, only about 4 feet deep, had been empty and was under the complete control of the Turks higher up. Ooh, so it's all the attack's breaking down, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's all too late. They advanced just 100 yards or so before taking shelter in the unoccupied Turkish trench at the pinnacle where the attack breaks down.
And that's the next bump after the apex. So there's the apex, which is a little pointy bit in the ridge, isn't it? Sticky out bit.
Now, it's at this point, Johnson ordered Malone to send his Wellington battalion on another charge up towards Chanuk Bahia.
How does that go for him?
Well, Malone stoutly refused, stating that he would not send his men over to commit suicide, but would wait for darkness.
Now, this is interesting, because I want you to bear that in mind for later on in this when we talk about the light horse at the neck. Malone does not obey orders. He fights back and he stands his ground. He does go out, he does take it that night. So it's worth bearing that in mind. Now, then orders arrive from Godley, the Lieutenant General Godley, that all offensive operations were to cease for the time being. And that's really that, isn't it? The Great Night Attack, how's it gone?
Well, it's failed. And I'm just adding up the number of objectives that they'd achieved, and that's none.
Yeah. But what about the linked attacks? Remember, there were the attacks. Remember, we said that German officers' trench across on Dead Man's Ridge and chessboard,
yep.
The neck. How are those attacks going to go? Because they're meant to be in cooperation with the New Zealanders, coordinated attacks as the New Zealanders pour down from Chanuk Bahia. But the New Zealanders haven't reached Chanuk Bahia. So what happens?
Well, the first of those attacks was the attack to be launched at midnight on the 6th of August by the 6th Battalion from Steele's Post onto German's officers' trench, which was designed to remove the flanking threat to the further attacks planned on the neck and the chessboard at 04:30 the next morning.
Now, you're going to do this, and this is interesting for me. We've stood on this ground. We've been and looked at where the German officers' trench is, and this is Major Henry Gordon Bennett of the 6th Victoria Battalion, Australian Battalion. And you're going to go through that. We'll come back to Gordon Bennett halfway through because it's a name that has some resonances for people of my generation.
Three tunnels, 3 to 4 foot wide and 7 foot deep, had been dug, leading from our front line for a distance of about 30 yards. These were linked up by another tunnel which was roughly parallel to our front line. A thin crust of earth from 6 to 12 inches thick was left as a roof to the tunnels. And from the forward tunnel, a number of narrow saps were dug, leading to small posts, each capable of accommodating 3 or 4 men. These saps were just wide enough for a man to crawl through. The attack was to be launched by the 6th Battalion from these fire posts at midnight. The roofs were to be removed just after dark, and the men were to charge across the intervening 20 yards to the enemy trench. The attack was to be preceded by 3 mine explosions at 11 p.m, 11:30 p.m, and 11:40 p.m. These mines, it was hoped, would destroy a portion of the enemy trench with its garrison and completely demoralise the rest of the troops holding that section of trench.
Now, until the mines have gone off, the attacking troops can't really occupy these forward tunnels you've just described, because they might collapse. So you're going to go on. So once again, your Major Henry Gordon Bennett.
As 11 o'clock approached, everyone waited anxiously to see yards of the enemy trench go skywards. But instead, there was a low muffled rumbling and a slight earth tremor. We peered over the parapet, expecting to see the flash of the explosion and tons of earth and a few Turks hurled into the air. But nothing happened. The mine was too deep to be effective. A minute or so later, we were all crouching low, hoping to dodge the shells the enemy poured on us in retaliation. Shell after shell landed in and around the trench, tearing great rents in the communication tunnels. At 11:30, the next mine was blown, with even less effect. This brought another hurricane of shells on Steele's post. We were beginning to feel depressed. We realised that the enemy, instead of being destroyed, or at least demoralised by them, had been made alert and ready. Then the third mine was blown at 11:40 with no better result.
Now, I remember what my father would have said in these circumstances. And you might remember your dad saying the same. Gordon Bennett! Because that's what people used to say. Do you remember that phrase?
I do.
You've looked it up, haven't you?
Yeah, it's not from that Gordon Bennett. It's from, there's two, father and son, but it's largely the son, James Gordon Bennett, who was the owner of the New York Herald.
Well, how did this... Because it means call... It's another way of saying call blimey, which in itself is God blind me.
Gordon Bennett, how did he get away with it? And basically, James Gordon Bennett appeared in the Guinness Book of Records at one stage for the most amazing faux pas at an engagement. And he appeared one New Year at his beloved's parents' house, got drunk, pissed in the fireplace and was flogged by his to-be brother-in-law the next morning with a horse whip. And surprisingly, the engagement was called off.
Oh.
But he was also the man who sent Stanley to look for Livingston.
Oh, so that's where the expression Gordon Bennett, as in, for fuck's sake.
How did he get away with that?
Get away with that. Not
that other word. No.
Oh, anyway.
But it's not this Gordon Bennett.
It's not this Gordon Bennett. But every time I see this bloke's name, it comes back to me, my father saying that to me after I've done something stupid, which was fairly frequent. Now, orders are orders. So the mines haven't worked, but they're going to have to try their best. So the men move into the tunnels to the underground front line. They're ready to break through up through the thin crust of earth, and then they got about 20 yards to charge across, and that was going to happen at 2400 hours at midnight. There's delays though, and 35 minutes past midnight, the men were in position ready to attack. We shouldn't be laughing because this isn't funny. It's
no, but it's
my inability to
your
work
inability
out.
To work out time. So is 2400 double zero?
Oh, I don't know.
No. Anyway, I'm going to be Major Henry Gordon Bennett again of the 6th Victoria Battalion. The signal for the assault was given, a blast of a whistle. Men in the fire post jumped out and rushed forward. The moment they did, the enemy raked no man's land with machine guns, rifles and bombs. The thin line melted away. Some were hit before they left the posts. Those who followed fell back wounded, blocking the saps and preventing the rest of the attacking force from leaving the tunnel. The wounded crawled back out of the inferno into the safe refuge of the tunnel, and before many minutes it was realised that the attack had failed.
So the dead and the wounded block the tunnels. That's the trouble with that. They're coming under fire not just from German officers' trench, but also from the machine guns and rifles up on the Quinn's Post on their left, if you can think of the ground, and Mortar Ridge to their front, and Johnson's Jolly, which is across further ahead, and Johnson's Jolly to their right. This is the thing about Anzac, everything's covered by fire from each of those posts, just like the Australian defences were. Now, Gordon Bennett sent back reports of the situation to brigade and divisional headquarters, but they don't know, they don't appreciate what's happening. To them, it's wish fulfilment. They want to take, they have to take German Officer's Trench, or the later attacks will be devastated by flanking fire. The morning attacks are on the neck and the chessboard and Quinn's Post. So they send forward a staff officer, and I'm going to be Captain Jess, Carl Jess, who's in the headquarters of 2nd Australian Brigade. And he's sent forward to see what's happening. And he says this: "The scene in the tunnel I shall never forget. Men leaning against the walls in the darkness without a word. And what their thoughts must have been, God only knows. But they must have been 100 times worse than mine. And I knew now how hopeless was the job, with no chance of surprise in it. However, it had to be tried. I found Colonel Bennett in the forward firing line, doing his best to reorganise his men, who were more or less stunned. The groans of the wounded still in the recesses, and the awful blackness and silence, were enough to take the heart out of anyone. Colonel Bennett himself wanted to lead the first line in the new attack, as he felt it was his duty. I would not agree. As I pointed out, it was his duty to feed with reinforcements the daring men who went out first. We eventually got the wounded and dying out, which I shall never forget, as they nearly all had 3 or 4 wounds, but seldom made a groan as they were pulled out of the recesses and along the bumpy, dark tunnel floor." So the first attack failed, and they're clearing the tunnels, dragging out the wounded. Can you imagine 3 or 4 wounds being dragged out through a tunnel? Pretty unceremoniously, no stretcher, just dragged along the floor.
Now, Bennett, he knew that a second attempt's a waste of lives, and he tried to get the assault cancelled, but he's not willing to disobey a direct order.
And also, he wants to go over leading his men, but he's told not to by Jess, and he doesn't. So what does he do?
So what he does is Bennett watches his men go to their deaths when the new attack was finally launched at 03:53 in the morning.
That's best part of 2 or 3 hours, 3 hours later.
And Major Henry Gordon Bennett of the 6th Victoria Battalion says this: "The enemy answered it with a hail of lead from the trench 20 yards away. Our men scrambled from their posts only to be shot down. A few survived to find themselves alone on reaching the enemy trench. As they essayed to return, they too were hit. For the second time, the assault had failed, not because the men were unwilling to face the danger, but because it was physically impossible to succeed."
Now, in all, they lost 80 killed and some 66 wounded. That's unusual balance of killed and wounded. This episode, you never hear about it, do you? I mean, I did put it in my book because that's where I've got this from. Because to me, it was just as dramatic as the neck. Not quite as lethal, but just as dramatic. It's got a bad consequence because they had to take this. Why?
Well, because it's all interlinked, as we've said.
And it's a Hamilton. Yeah. Well, it's not. He's not directly. It's a Skeen and Birdwood.
But they are all interlinked assaults. And the assaults that are planned for 04:30 the next day on the neck, the chessboard and Dead Man's Ridge from Quinn's Post, that's all interlinked. And those attacks, they're already heavily reliant for success on the success of the New Zealand Brigade in capturing Chinook Bear and then launching a simultaneous attack down through Battleship Hill onto Baby 700.
We know that's not happening because they're at that time, 4:30, they're still on the road down the ridge. But now they're also going to get fire from from German Officers' Trench because the 6th Victoria Battalion have not taken it. So what's going to happen? What are high commands doing about it?
Well, at ANZAC Corps headquarters, Birdwood and Skeen considered the situation reports. Now, they knew the New Zealanders were well behind schedule and still struggling up Rhododendron Ridge. It's a difficult decision, but as Skeen put it...
And you're going to be him, aren't you?
I'm going to be Brigadier General Andrew Skeen. "It is not the light horse I am anxious about. I think they will be all right. What I hope is that they will help the New Zealanders."
Oh dear, things are... That's not how things are meant to be working,
no,
is it?
That's against what's supposed to be happening. Now, Birdwood decides to proceed on the grounds that the frontal assault would pin the Turkish garrison and prevent them from moving reserves to block the New Zealanders.
Well, we already know that Cannon Geiss's 9th Division, Turkish Division, is doing now. It's a bit of a sacrifice too far, and this is how the Third Light Horse Brigade come to go over the top of the neck, and the whole legend of the neck is started. Now, what's the basic plan? Take me through the basic plan for the attack of the Light Horse Brigade.
Well, they go over in four waves, 150 men in each, with the 8th Light Horse having the dubious honour of going over the top first. There's a slow preliminary bombardment which blazed into life at 0400, with shells pouring down onto the Turkish trenches at both the neck and the chessboard.
Yeah, I bet it wasn't. I think it's not going to be that good, though, is it? I'm just going by Gallipoli barrages, a shortage of artillery, the shortage of shells. What was it? Was it that good?
Well, it was impressive, but it looked more destructive than it actually was, and it's been alleged to have ended prematurely at 0423.
Now this is a big controversy, and it's like who shot Richtof. It's one of those controversies that I can't really engage with, because to me, I think it's something and nothing. That there's been a lot of work done on this. What's one big factor about being too precise about times in 1915?
Well, we've said it a number of times. You've not only got the relative inaccuracy of timepieces in number of 15, but you've got inadequate synchronisation, and that's the most likely cause. And you're in the heat of battle. You know, in all probability, it made little difference to the outcome.
You think they'd have been slaughtered anyway?
I think in all probability, yes.
Now, so the bombardment either does or doesn't stop early. The light horse do not go over. There seems to have been a gap. How long that gap is, I have no idea. The Turks, they're cocking their rifles. They're getting their machine guns up into position. Now, how does Lieutenant Colonel Alexander White, commanding the 8th Light Horse, how does he react?
Well, he insists on leading his men over the top, which we've discussed this before, Pete, a very brave and courageous gesture. But at the same time, he's neglecting his real role in providing tactical leadership. And you've got to ask the question, perhaps the Light Horse should have attacked immediately the barrage stopped. But the confusion was too great. The time was too short to react quickly enough. And the first wave leapt over the parapet at 4:30. In front of them lay the neck with 60 BLs to cross to the Turkish trenches. And right. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander White is leading them.
And I think he was wrong. I think he was brave, and I admire him enormously in that sense. But when you look at the other leadership, led by Malone, who just said, naff off. and then, of course, Gordon Bennett. It's not his name, Henry Gordon Bennett. But Major Bennett had also wanted to go over the top, but had been persuaded out of it because he needed to. He had other jobs to do, and I think that's the point. But that does not detract from the courage shown. Shown by White, a brave man, a very brave man. He knew his men were going to their deaths, and he decided to go with them. He didn't have to, but he did. Now I'm going to be Sergeant Cliff Pinnock of the 8th Light Horse. They're from Victoria as well. A bad day in Victoria. And he says this: "They were waiting ready for us and simply gave us a solid wall of lead. I was in the first line to advance and we did not get 10 yards. Everyone fell like lumps of meat. All your pals that had been with you for months and months, blown and shot out of all recognition. I got mine shortly after got over the bank, and it felt like a million-ton hammer falling on my shoulder. I was really awfully lucky as the bullet went in just below the shoulder blade, ran by my throat, and came out just a tiny way from my spine, low down on the back. It was simply murder. Doesn't sound that lucky to me, but I know what he means. He got away with it."
And fire's pouring in from ahead, from the left, from the right. There's absolutely no question about the presence of machine guns this time.
Yeah, this isn't like the landings where it's controversial. These are machine guns and blazing rifles. They're down in the dirt, aren't they? How long do you think it takes for them to get dealt with?
Well, it's around about 30 seconds. And Then there's a second wave that follows and was slaughtered 2 minutes later.
Anyone to stop that second wave?
No, because he was leading the first wave.
Yeah, precisely. Now, in the chaos, one of the signal flags that's meant to indicate progress had been reported as briefly fluttering in the Turkish front line on the right, as you look at it looking forward. I don't think it means anything. Whoever was carrying it was definitely dead, if it existed at all. But this report causes false optimism in higher authorities. And Lieutenant Colonel Noel Brazier, now, behind the first two waves are the 8th Light Horse. The second two, the third and fourth waves will be the 10th Light Horse, commanded by, as I said, Lieutenant Colonel Noel Brazier. Now, he, Brazier, rushes back to brigade headquarters to try and get the attack abandoned. But what happens?
Well, it's all a bit in vain. The cursed sighting of a signal flag in the Turkish front line, it's had its effect. And, of course, Colonel White, he wasn't there to support Brazier's efforts, as he was dead.
Nor was the brigadier who was observing from the bit that's just been cleared. So it's Bull Antill, who in the Gallipoli film speaks with an English accent, but was a purebred Australian. And that's a kind of childishness that can detract from what is otherwise an excellent entertaining film. It's not historically accurate, but it's not meant to be, I suppose. It's just a film. Now, so what happens? They can't stop the third wave, can they?
No, the third wave's ordered over at 0445, and at this point, everybody knew that it was hopeless.
And then it's really tragic, but some of the fourth wave actually go over at 5:15. The situation is so confused, they've got no clear orders. Now, this is Sergeant William Sanderson of the 10th Western Australia Light Horse, and he says this: "The rhododendron bushes had been cut off with machine gun fire and were all spiky. The Turks were too deep in the trench ahead. There was at least one machine gun on the left and any number in the various trenches on the chessboard. The men who were going out were absolutely certain that they were going to be killed, and they expected to be killed right away. The thing that struck a man most was if he wasn't knocked in the first 3 yards." Well, that's something, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, meanwhile, the first light horse, they're launching an audacious, or could be termed suicidal, attack from Pope's Hill across Waterfall Gully and directed against the Turkish trenches on Dead Man's Ridge and the chessboard immediately behind it.
Now, we've been there, haven't we? It's just been cleared.
This is last year. This is 2020.
And we could get onto Pope's Hill and look across to Dead Man's Ridge and the chessboard. And that's what this attack has come from. Now, who should read this, do you think?
Well, I think it was originally going to be you, but I think it's now me, because you've come out of sequence. So I'm going to be Lieutenant Geoffrey Harris of the 1st New South Wales Light Horse. "We quickly took the first two lines of trenches in our course, bombing the Turks out. Our bombers went on and took the third line trenches on a narrow front, and we could just see the Turks getting back along their communication trenches. It was just breaking daylight when we went over the hill to be met by the Crescent Trench, full of Turks, half out their trench, waiting for us. Machine guns were barking on three sides of us. Seeing that we could get no further, I gave the order, 'Down!' and went to earth just as a bullet hit my shoulder. Sergeant Ellis went down on my right, killed instantly, riddled with bullets at close range. Luckily, I fell in a small depression out of sight of the Turks."
Now, Harris, Geoffrey Harris, he managed to get back safely, but all over Dead Man's Ridge, and this is an amazing sight. The various parties of the 1st Light Horse are trying to consolidate. They've just about got a grip, they think, on Dead Man's Ridge. They're trying to consolidate, and I'm going to be Corporal David Lindsay of the 1st New South Wales Light Horse, and he says this: "At present, I'm lying on the side of the hill, trying to keep under a bit of cover. Bombs are terrible, dead all around. God help and protect me. I'm not scared, but it's hell. Could not hold position. Bombed out of it. I was dodging bombs all the time. Writing this as I rest on the way back. Suppose we'll have another go later on. It's hell right enough. Where I was lying on the hill, there were four dead chaps beside me and in front of me. No one living. Bombs, I think. Don't think we ran when we retreated. We damn well walked. Most of us, especially the survivors of the charge, are very weak and feel sore and bruised all over the body where sticks, stones hit us as they were chucked up by exploding bombs. Four or five of our wounded chaps are still lying out under the Turkish trenches. I would volunteer to go and have a cut for them, but it's sheer suicide. I could no more carry a man at present than fly. I'm too sore and feel very weak. Wow. So what happens? Do they hold it? Do they hold it?
No, in the end, the First Light Horse were all forced to retreat with absolutely nothing achieved. Now, all of the attacks had been failures, pursued with the utmost gallantry and bravery, but as serious operations of war, they were nothing more than unprofessional madness.
I think you're right. You can't advance against mass machine gun fire and rifle fire. Courage can't get you through it. Just you can't win in those circumstances. Now, the thing that has come to symbolise this is the sacrifice of the 8th and 10th Light Horse at the Neck. Gordon Bell, the 6th Battalion and the 1st Light Horse have been almost forgotten. But the sacrifice of the 8th and 10th Light Horse at the Neck has become sort of really the focus of attention, hasn't it? What were the casualties?
Well, there were 372 casualties, of which 234 were dead.
Now, that is a lot, and it's a terrible situation, isn't it? Why do you think it's got such a notoriety? Is it just the film, or is it just
no?
The film
there's populist Australian attempts to link the slaughter there with the British failure to progress as planned at Suvla, and to link the two, and they're not linked.
That's a bit of a red herring, I would say, on balance. Why did they fail?
Well, there were only slender hopes of success on the Neck anyway, but they were entirely dependent on the New Zealanders' capture of Chanuk Bahia and had nothing whatever to do with what was going on down at Suvla. It was all about Chanuk Bahia and what the New Zealanders did.
So it was a terrible failure. I often try and point out that when we talk about this sacrifice, it is a terrible sacrifice. But, of course, those same 8th and 10th Light Horse had slaughtered the same number of Turks when they made a similar attack in June over the same ground. And they'd had a great time shooting people down then. Well, I suppose it all depends on your perspective in an attack, whether you're the ones being slaughtered or doing the slaughtering. It's a terrible place. And to visit the Neck now is quite a somber business, isn't it? Because the trenches have been cleared. It's all there. What do you think of the... Let's talk about the overall plans, because we're stopping it. We're only doing the offensive's first night, if you like, and the next day. What do you think of the plans? How would you sum it all up, Gary? You've heard what I've got to say. I've heard what you've got to say. Let's sum it up.
Well, it's typically Hamilton. It's almost as if they're stretching for more and more complicated schemes. And there was a rash of schemes from end to end on the peninsula. Instead of concentrating on one area, it just seems that there were two elements supposedly dependent on each other, but they couldn't support each other because they were physically separate entities.
So just like in the landings,
it sounds exactly like the landings. It's and again, there are diversions that turn into major operations in themselves.
Well, the fighting continues for days at Hellas. There's thousands of 3,000 odd casualties at Hellas.
It's totally unrealistic if you take it as a whole. It demanded feats of endurance from the assaulting columns climbing up Surrey Bear, which would have made Hannibal think twice, frankly.
What about his elephants?
No, his elephants would have loved it. It demanded that raw troops perform like veterans, and this is a point you make over and over again.
I do.
That sickly veterans put their illnesses behind them and carry on.
That's an unfortunate choice of words, Gary. No. Because their illness involves a lot of...
It's the best place for it, to be frank. Yeah. But they were really, again, you've described this before, it's not like Bain's disease.
Was a slightly upset tummy.
Yeah. Dysentery is debilitating to an extreme.
Yeah. And you can't put it behind you. And you can die of thirst if you don't get enough water. So it also, at one point, and I'm thinking of Johnson here, really, the New Zealander, it demands great leadership from incompetence or inadequates. diversions, attacks that are bound to fail in a welter of blood and death and misery. And what's the worst thing of all, Gary?
Well,
what is the biggest mistake that they make time and time and time again?
Well, despite all the evidence to the contrary, it demands that the Turks fight badly.
Is that likely to happen?
Not in the defence, Pete. They're very, very, very good soldiers in the defence.
Well, it's a chastening tale. The Turks do brilliantly in defence. We've not done much about them, and the only quote we've had is from a German. We haven't got Turkish quotes. If you were to do this, if we had the quotes, we'd be all over it, because the Turks they fight brilliantly throughout this, don't they?
They do.
They're resourceful, they react quickly, and they do brilliantly. And our lads, they're brave, but we're beaten again, aren't we?
We are, and you could argue we were beaten from the start because, as you say, the plan was overcomplicated and there was a lack of leadership from a number of people on the ground.
Okay, well, chastening again. Okay, Gary, well, thank you for joining me in this exploration of disaster.
Cheers, Pete. I'm now going to kill this bloody fly.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?